maybe it's the TV, maybe it's the cigarettes, maybe it's a family, maybe it's a fast food, maybe it's the news, maybe it's divorce, maybe it's abuse, maybe it's the lawyers, maybe it's the prisons, maybe it's the senators, maybe it's the system, maybe it's the fathers, maybe it's the sons, maybe it's the sisters, maybe it's the moms, maybe it's the radio, maybe it's road rage, maybe El Nino, will you re-raise, maybe it's the army, maybe it's the liquor, maybe it's the papers, maybe the militia, maybe it's the athletes, maybe it's the ads, maybe it's the sports fans, maybe it's a fad, maybe it's the magazines, maybe it's the internet, maybe it's a lottery, maybe it's the immigrants, maybe it's taxes, big business, maybe it's the KKK and the skinheads, maybe it's the communists, maybe it's the Catholics, maybe it's the hippies, maybe it's the addicts, maybe it's the art, maybe it's the sex, maybe it's the homeless, maybe it's the banks, maybe it's the clear cut, maybe it's the ozone, maybe it's the chemicals, maybe it's the car phone, maybe it's the fertilizer, maybe it's the nose rings, maybe it's the ends, but I know one thing, if it were up to me, I'd take away the guns, I'd take away the guns.
I'm D. May Roberts, stage and studio. We're listening to music from the film Rope by Alfred Hitchcock. We're featuring the 1929 play that Hitchcock adapted into that film. It's opening this week at Bag and Baggage Productions in Hillsboro, and that's running October 8th through November 1st. We'll be talking with Rusty Newton Tennant, who's directing their production of Rope. And then we'll hear from Tony Award-winning playwright David Henry Hwang. Theater Diaspora will be performing his play, The Sound of a Voice, on October 17th at 2 p.m. and October 25th at 7 p.m. at Portland Center Stage, and it features live Japanese flute music by Larry Terrell and movement by Chisao Hata. We'll hear more about that play, so stay tuned for this full show. It's Stage and Studio. I'm D. May Roberts. With me in the KBOO studio is director Rusty Newton Tennant. Welcome back, Rusty.
Hi.
And that music just kind of takes you back to another time period, doesn't it?
I know, and I love the movie, actually, the movie version of Rope. It's, I had never seen it. I'm not a Hitch geek.
Well, I actually am, but what was your reaction to it?
Well, you know, I mean, I know the basics. I've seen the basics when it comes to Hitchcock. You know, especially with Birdman just having come out and really attempting that one take feel, it was really relevant, especially with that having just come out and having been so successful. So I thought it was kind of interesting to see people trying the same gimmick, if you will, for, you know, this many years apart from one another. I'm partial to the play because
that's where you started from, was the play itself.
I knew the play before I knew the movie.
Right,
And I think that a lot of people are actually going to come at this in reverse, and it will be more people will have actually seen the movie.
Yeah, because they adapted the play, so there's probably a lot more characters and a lot
and
more.
And a number of years after the play was written. I mean, the play was written in 1929. So there was a number of years between that and when the adaptation into the film. Hitchcock did a lot to... I think it was Hume Cronin who adapted the actual screenplay. I might be wrong.
Yes, no, you're right. Okay, that's exactly right. Well, the early play, you know, Hitchcock did turn it into one of his most experimental films, which is basically, I think there was only two takes, and you can see the edit at one point in
the
middle.
He had to cut for the reel.
Right.
The reel switch.
They had to, and that's the only reason he cut that.
Yeah.
But it was a different way of doing it, and it basically is filmed as a staged play. I mean, it's one set, except for the opening opening scene, but it was written by Patrick Hamilton, the original play, and it was based on the Leopold and Lieb murders. Is that Lieb or Loeb?
Leopold and Loeb
murders of by two young men who just wanted to see if they could get away with killing a fellow student.
Yeah, and you know, Patrick Hamilton had quite a bit to say as to whether or not it was actually based on those murders and what the reference is. It's interesting because I did Machinal a few years ago, and Sophie Treadwell had a similar sort of argument about whether hers was based on a true story or not. I think it's just, we write about topical things, and probably it was topical at that stage of the game. it's certainly a different story than the Leopold and Loeb story. It's fascinating because to me, Nietzsche is brought up endlessly in this script, and referenced and almost blamed for this, the way all this goes down. So it has a lot of, I think that. In actuality, Patrick Hamilton, was a Marxist and very anti-war. And I think it all came from that more than it probably came from any sort of like headlines. The headlines were probably just the hook to hang the hat on more than anything.
Well, and I also think that since you brought that up, it seems like it's also anti-class or upper class, because it's these two guys that think they're superior to everybody else because of their mental, superiority. But they actually were sociopaths.
Well, particularly Brandon, the lead, the kind of his story, is certainly a sociopath. No doubt about it. His buddy Granillo has some, motives of his own, and really, Nathan Duncan, who we probably all know and love, is playing the part, and he and I have had some real talks. He has to go on an insane journey, the poor guy does, and so we're working on ways to make sure that doesn't become detrimental to the actor himself, mentally, because the process of Granillo, is very different. He feels every bit of it, every bit of what has just happened. Granillo takes in, and the piece is so interesting because it is an absolute piece of naturalism. I mean, I'm much more versed and much more prolific these days in doing like postmodern work and things that are maybe a little bit more esoteric, and this is absolute naturalism. This is slice of life. Aristotle's three unities are firmly intact. We are in one place. It is one specific set amount of time, and it is one tightly woven plot. You know what I mean? So it's a unique piece to work on for me in that way, because I don't often.
It's very traditional of what you're saying, sense of structure.
I really did approach it with a sense of nostalgia. I didn't run from the fact that this is 1929. I mean, and Bag and Baggage's stage is so perfect for this style of play because it was written for the proscenium. It's that murder mystery. Mm-hmm. It was written for that kind of space. So in many ways, it fits so perfectly. I didn't want to gussy it up or underline or highlight or anything like that. And not only that, I've said it over and over with these guys, 80% of what makes a show good is good casting, and this is a really great cast.
We have a really good cast.
Yeah.
Well, and I think what's pertinent about, this, because it is a psychological thriller trying to get into the minds of these two killers, it's a way for the audience to be pulled into figuring exactly what's in the head, what they're going through. Why would they even do something like this and have no empathy for another human being?
Well, because there are schools of thought, great schools of thought, that teach us that death is the greatest reward, that death is and specifically Nietzsche gets very strongly in this idea that if you're going to live, then you must live dangerously. And that's really what Brandon kind of keeps coming back to, is this idea of, I did this to live dangerously. And for those who watched American Horror Story this past season, Freak Show wasn't my favorite season, but the Dandy character is very similar to Brandon in that way. And they're just bored. He's so bored. And I think it's one of the interesting things that Hitchcock kind of highlights in the way that he plays with time in the piece as well, is this pressure of time that we feel, and especially when you're rich and you have really few concerns. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And he's just bored.
Well, how pertinent is it to today's world? What do these characters say to today's world?
Well, I mean, death never goes away. Murder never goes away. I mean, we experience it in various different forms and various different ways. So obviously, there's the immediate to what we're experiencing as a community, as a state, as a country right now, and when we deal with death, but also just on a personal level. What Brandon does, and Brandon and Granillo, in the play, is they murder this person, this friend of theirs, and put his body in a box at one end of the room.
And it's really it's right in the middle of the stage.
It is.
Or, I mean,
in many ways, it's what the audience has to look through.
Exactly.
In many ways.
Yeah.
But they put this body in a box, and then they invite all of his friends and family over and have a dinner literally served off from the box itself. You say, oh my gosh, like that's horrifying and that's gross.
It is horrifying.
No. Every time someone dies, we do something almost exactly.
Oh, you like a wake? Yeah.
A wake or a funeral. I just went to my best friend from high school, just passed away this past week. And I sat in there in that room and I watched us staring at him in a pine box at the end of a room. Probably not a pine box, but in a wooden box at the end of the room. And all of his friends and family had been invited there. And afterwards, we served a dinner.
I think what's the difference, though, is that you knew.
We know, but I'm just saying there is a there's a statement on the ritual.
Right.
You know what I mean? And it's,
so they created their own. These two men created their own ritual.
And it's a Nietzsche. You know, it's based in Nietzsche, but there is a statement on this ritual the parallel is interesting to me.
Oh, well, you know, and how we deal with death, you know, is so personal. I was thinking in terms of the recent shooting at Umpqua Community College, and I was actually going down to Ashland when, you know, all these police cars were passing me, and I learned later that the reason why of what happened in Roseburg. I was wondering if you and the cast have had discussions about, you know, recent events.
Well, I was actually on a plane. And I'm not a very good flyer, and I tend to take Xanax in order to fly, and I don't get on Facebook and I don't do any of that sort of stuff when I'm flying. I didn't know anything about it until that night when I landed in Weberville, Michigan, where I'm from. And they told me, they're like, did you know anybody in the shooting? And I was like, shooting? What are you talking about? And there's like, there's a shooting in Portland, Oregon. Well, then I soon learned that it wasn't actually in Portland. But they had no idea in the difference. And I just got back on Sunday night. Our focus at this stage of the game is tech. We're in tech. We've got our show. We haven't had a time or a moment to really sit down and say, what does this say to our community at this point in time? Probably more because the piece is I describe it as candy, or particularly for me, dark chocolate, in the sense that I know this is a sinful piece, but it is delicious. It is so fun. It is so enjoyable as a piece. I don't know, you know. Is this the piece to have that discussion with? I'm not certain that it
is.
Right. And particularly right now, if we find ourselves on Wednesday thinking, yeah, let's just have this discussion and talk about this, you know, that's what we'll do. But until then, we've got to get light cues and sound cues, particularly my sound cues that I've been working on.
At its heart, it's still a psychological thriller, and it's more of a whodunit. Well, the audience knows whodunit, but who will find out whodunit?
Yeah, I love that term of the murder mystery in reverse, because the first moment of the show, you know who murdered these people or this kid. It's moving forward that you're the real mystery is in who finds out and who knows
how they will this discovery, right?
Yeah.
And still, there's still important things that are brought out in the play regarding death and how we view it as a society. Wrote by Patrick Hamilton, the play that inspired the Alfred Hitchcock classic is directed by Rusty Newton Tennant. The show opens October 8th and runs through November 1st. All shows are at the Venetian Theater. That's located at 253 East Main Street in Hillsboro. Performance times are Thursday, Friday, Saturday at 7:30 p.m. and Sundays at 2 p.m. For more info, call 503-345-9590. That's 345-9590. Or visit baggage.org. And I have that link at stageandstudio.org too. Rusty, in the time remaining, I just wanted to talk a little bit about Bag and Baggage. It just won the recognition from the American Theater Wing for one of the 12 regional theaters that was recognized and awarded.
Right.
Quite prestigious for a regional theater in Hillsboro, Oregon.
Absolutely. Bag and Baggage is great. Scott Palmer is a fundraising and managerial genius, I think. And I really love the programming that they're getting into. And you know, I'm start. This is this year has been kind of a step in a new direction. Scott has directed the majority of the things that have happened out there for the past few years, and he's brought in a few outside directors this year, myself being lucky enough to be one of those people. And that's always exciting for me as a director, because anybody who's going to support local directors and give us opportunities, I think that's a great thing. But their new space out there is going to be something.
And it's a beautiful old theater.
The Venetian is this great old proscenium stage that is, it has this great nostalgia to it. But their new space that they're going to move into, oh my Lord, I cannot wait.
Well, it sounds like they're getting a lot of artists from Portland to go there, and as well as a lot of audiences.
And deservedly so. I mean, it's not that far to drive out there.
Well, give us logistics. How long?
I mean, I can make it back into town in about 30 minutes. I mean, and I live in the Northeast, so it's not that big of a long drive out there. And I think we in Portland, we get a little insular in our community, and we don't want to get too far out of here and all this. It's not far, and the theater is really great. It's a great, and they have a restaurant attached right to the theater, so you can go and have your little dinner right there, boom, right before you go into the theater. It's great. I think it's a wonderful place, and it's definitely giving a lot of great opportunities to local artists.
Well, so, in the last 30 seconds, what else is happening for you that's coming up?
I'm going to be in Oregon Children's Theater production coming up here, acting again, and I haven't acted in a while, and it's going to be fun. I get to play a grumpy old mouse. Immediately following that, I'm going to be doing Fuse has some plans for something in February and March, but I'm going to hold off on
that. Yeah, yeah. Okay, well, we'll talk more.
And then Measure for Measure at Clark College. Wonderful. In May.
So. Well, you're a great director, so kudos to you, and have a great opening weekend.
Thank you so much.
Rusty Newton Tennant, great visiting with you yet again, and have a great time at Bag and Baggage Productions with Rope. If you missed any of this interview or want to see photos of Rusty and me with a selfie, go to stageandstudio.org or kboo.fm/stage. Stage and Studio, and we'll have a podcast up on both those pages. Next up, I'll be talking with Tony Award-winning playwright David Henry Wong. First, let's hear some music being featured live in the production of the play The Sound of a Voice. This music is by Larry Terrell, a Portland master of the Shakuhachi flute. You can find out more about his music at moonbridge.com. I'm Dime Roberts, Stage and Studio. Joining us via phone is playwright David Henry Wong. Hello again, David.
Hi, how are you?
Oh, good. It's good to hear your voice. Are you talking to us from New York?
I am. I'm in my little home office in Brooklyn.
All right. Well, we first talked with you when Portland Center Stage was doing a production of your play Chinglish in January of 2014. Boy, the time just flies by. And you were just recently, actually, in L.A. for a production at East West Players of Chinglish. How did that go?
That was received very well in L.A., and I think that particularly because it's East West Players, which is the nation's oldest Asian American theater, as a matter of fact, it's the oldest minority group.
I think, yeah, it's the oldest ethnic theater, right, 50 years old, right.
So particularly because of that, I think they paid great attention to the Mandarin, and I think it was much more authentic in that sense than any previous production, and it's been reviewed and selling very well, so that's nice. And there's also a Chinglish going up in Singapore in a few days. So.
Well, it's just all over. I mean, do you keep track of all the plays that are happening, of your plays that are happening around the country?
You know, honestly, the way I find out is just by Googling myself regularly. I mean, there are people who keep track of it, but they don't necessarily tell me, and so if I, go on the web, I can figure out what's going on.
Or people like me call you or Facebook you and go, hey, doing something with you. Well, another thing that's happening with you, and I'm not sure how much you're involved in it, but you're involved with, it's not a new show, but the second season of The Affair on HBO, which premiered last Sunday. Are you, I read that you were working on the series.
Yeah, I'm part of the writing producing team for season two. And the show is created by Sarah Treem, who happens to be one of my dearest friends. She's actually a former mentee, which I suppose is
interesting.
Good reason for, you know, to be nice to your, you know, your younger students or artists who are coming up.
It pays, right?
So I've been working to create a television show of my own, and so around Christmas last year, Sarah was like, well, why don't you, you know, come write for my show and you can learn about TV. And it was a great idea, and I've been having a wonderful time working on the affair and learning a ton. So if I get to have my own series, I think I'll be much better as a result of having worked on the affair, and also really enjoyed the show, and I'm very proud of it.
Well, did you were you involved in the writing of the episode that just premiered on Sunday?
I was part of the writer's room, so we broke all the story together is the term. You know, we decided everything as a group, decided everything that was going to happen in all the episodes. And then I personally wrote two of the episodes, which will be the 6th and the 9th episodes for the season.
Okay. All right. I'm looking forward to that. You know, I watched the first season and I wasn't quite sold on coming back to it for the second season. And then I read that you were involved, and so I checked it out, and I actually love the episode that I saw, you know, seeing other people's point of view, you know?
Yeah, I mean, and that was always Sarah's concept for this season. That was before I got involved even, but that she wanted to expand the points of view. And I think that we've had a really good team of writers. We all really respect each other. We've all gotten along well, and I can see where, if that wasn't the case, working on a TV show could be a very unpleasant experience.
Right, right.
We had a really good time.
Well, are there going to be any Asian characters? Can you give us any spoilers about that?
I'm not supposed to give spoilers, but I can tell you that, yes, there will be some Asian characters.
Yay! Well, so you said you were developing your own show, though. Are you going to, you know, continue that?
I mean, that's been announced. So I'm basically creating a show which is kind of like Sex and the City set in contemporary Shanghai. So it's a little bit like the play Chinglish in tone. And, you know, we've been developing it, and we don't have a green light to have it made yet, but we're very hopeful, and so
that sounds
we'll see
fun.
If that goes forward.
Yeah, I did read about that. That sounds fun, so I hope it does go forward. Well, I personally want to say that I owe you a lot for inspiring something here in Portland because of the outreach that Portland Center Stage was doing regarding Chinglish. I got involved and hosted a staged reading of one of your earlier plays, The Dance in the Railroad, and that led to the formation of Portland's first Asian American theater company called Theater Diaspora. So thank you, David, for that inspiration. And
fantastic.
We're actually ending our 2015 calendar season with another of your earlier plays, The Sound of a Voice. Mm-hmm. So it's like, you know, someday we'll do one of your modern ones, your more contemporary ones.
It works out very well for me that you're thanking me, but I'm thanking you because it gives me a new venue for my work to be done in Portland.
Well, that, you know, I want you to go back in time because that play was in 1983. And so I wanted to, you know, my question to you is, why did you decide to focus on a Japanese folktale, because it's about it's a ghost story about a woman who lives in the woods and the samurai is there to kill her. I was wondering, what was your inspiration? Can you go back that far and tell us about that?
You know, I think what's interesting is that because I've been doing this for a while, that is being a playwright, when I was looking to Asia for relatively contemporary artistic inspiration, in the late 70s and early 80s, really the place to look was Japan. Now, this is not a contemporary story, but the artists who were coming out of Japan, the filmmakers, the designers, to someone who grew up in the West, were much more kind of inspirational in terms of being able to blend Asian influences with Western influences simply by virtue of the fact that those artists had been exposed to Western art, film, theater, for many decades. And China, at that point, was only just coming out of its isolation post the Cultural Revolution. So as a result, I ended up watching a lot of Japanese movies, reading a lot of Japanese literature. And so that was really what inspired The Sound of a Voice and a companion piece that I wrote at the time called The House of Sleeping Beauties, which was an adaptation of a novella by the Nobel Prize winning Japanese author Yasunari Kawabata. So those were two pieces that were kind of written at the same time, which were influenced by just my absorption of Japanese aesthetics, contemporary Japanese aesthetics in the late 70s and early 80s.
Well, did you originally hear a ghost story or the folktale itself?
No, I think it's because, I think it's from like seeing the Shinoda movie, Kwaidan, there was another one that I think it's Shinoda made Kwaidan. If not, there's also a one that I remember watching with the great Onagata, the kabuki actor, who, you know, the men who play women, mm-hmm. Tamasaburo. And Tamasaburo was also in a Japanese ghost story movie that made it to the West. And so I think it was more through reading the literature and seeing the movies of the period.
Well, I think it's fascinating that you wrote essentially a middle-aged love story when you were quite young.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I don't quite know how that all happened.
Well, it's great that that you know you're talking about this, because we're going to also be talking via Skype live on October 17th after the 2 p.m. performance of Sound of a Voice at Portland Center Stage for Theater Diaspora. So in the time remaining, though, I want to ask you about some current stuff that you're working on. Are you still working on a production for the American History Cycle at Oregon Shakespeare Festival?
I am, and I'm hoping to. I've been working on creating a piece about the American colonial period in the Philippines. My mother's family came, they're ethnic Chinese from the Philippines, and they'd been there for several generations. And as a kid, I used to visit my grandparents in the Philippines because, again, during this period, China was closed to the West, and you couldn't go there. And so I actually have a lot more just childhood memories of the Philippines, certainly than I do of China, and yet I've never written about it. So that's the piece that I'm working on for OSF.
Seems like you're focusing internationally in your themes right now.
Well, you know, certainly during the Qinglish period and since then, I've become very interested in internationalism, the way in which a lot of the things that we learned during the growth of multiculturalism in America, for instance, the notion that different cultures see the world differently, that, you know, I've started to feel that it's not enough to simply apply those ideas within our own borders, but we need to look at them in terms of America's relationship to the world. So I think going back to M. Butterfly, I've always been somewhat interested in internationalism.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
I seem to be more sort of focused on them at the moment.
So when can we expect to see, I'm sounding like your dramaturg, so when can we see your reading at the Oregon Shakespeare Festival?
That's
a
very good question, and they're
probably asking you that.
People would like to know that too. And first I'll tell them.
So it could be any time in the next year, let's just say then.
I'm really hoping in the next year that we can do a reading of the first draft.
That would be awesome, especially for just a shout out there. There's going to be a conference confest at for the National Asian American Theater Consortium, the Consortium of Asian American Theater Artists, CATA, in the first week of October. So maybe by then, huh?
of next year.
Well, David Henry Wong, it's been such a pleasure to talk with you again, and we'll be talking again via Skype on October 17th after the 2 p.m. performance of Sound of a Voice, and I'll give more details about that later. But David Henry Wong, thank you so much for joining us, and we'll talk to you soon.
Thanks for having me on, and I look forward to the 17th.
You take care.
Okay, bye.
Theater Diaspora presents David Henry Wong's one-act play, The Sound of a Voice, on October 17th at 2 p.m. and October 25th at 7 p.m. at Portland Center Stage. If you want to ask David a question of your own, check out the Skype talk after the October 17th performance. The show is 45 minutes long. For more info, visit theaterdiaspora.org or reserve tickets at pcs.org. And anyone who wants a financial hardship discount, you can email theaterdiaspora@gmail.com. The Sound of a Voice features Japanese dance by actress Giselle Hata and portrays the woman in the woods, and Larry Toda portrays the samurai. It's a haunting ghost story directed by Samson Searoth, and the play features music by Larry Terrell. Let's hear a little bit of that, Janet. A little bit of the Larry Terrell music while I'm reading the rest of this. There we go. He's a master of shakuhachi flute. lives right here in Portland. He'll be playing music live for both performances, that's October 17th at 2 p.m., October 25th at 7 p.m. at Portland Center Stage. That's it for Stage and Studio. Thank you to my incredible engineer, Janet Anderson. I'll have photos and links as well as all the guest info at stageandstudio.org, and I'll also have a podcast of this show later today at stageandstudio.org. And please do like us on facebook.com/stage2nstudio or tweet me at @StageTheLetterNStudio. Till next time, I'm Dimay Roberts. We're going to go out with more music by master shakuhachi player Larry Terrell, and you can get his music at moonbridge.com.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to present A Hard Day's Night as part of the KBOO at the Clinton Monthly Film Series. The Beatles made this film in 1964 as they portray a rock and roll band traveling from Liverpool to London for a television broadcast, and wackiness ensues. Again, that's A Hard Day's Night, Thursday, October 8th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to present an evening of music and dialogue on the climate and jobs crisis Saturday, October 10th at 6:30 p.m. Joe Uline is a labor leader who will discuss the urgency and the climate crisis and the response that must be made in carbon neutral work, education, and more. Again, that's an evening of music and dialogue on the climate and job crisis Saturday, October 10th, 6:30 p.m. at the AFL-CIO Hall at 3645 Southeast 32nd Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.